Publishing Talks, a podcast about the book industry. I'm David Wilk, your host. Today I'm talking to Mark Teppo. Mark's an author. He's got a series of urban fantasy books called The Codex of Souls. But what we're talking about today is not his, or not principally his own work in the past, but I want to talk today about The Mongoliad, which is a bigger project that Mark is involved in, and actually hopefully get a lot of get some information about it for people who don't know anything about it, and get an update on where it is going, where it is today, and where it's going. Anyway, that's a long introduction. Mark, how are you?
I'm good. How are you doing this morning?
I'm good. I'm really glad to talk to you. Maybe you could, you know, you could give a brief history of the Mongoliad. You know, it's for people who are listening. If you want to go to the website, it's MONGOLIAD.com. It's Neil Stevenson, Greg Bear, and friends. You know, you'll see what the Mongoliad is. It's a pretty novel, very interesting new development in writing. So maybe you could talk about it, Mark.
Yeah, so essentially the idea came down to Neil and Greg and some of the other writers and I, we get together once a week and we hit each other with swords, is the short story, the short version of that. And after we hit each other with swords, we reward ourselves by going out and getting, you know, some baked goods. And invariably, whenever you get a bunch of writers sitting around a table, someone will eventually start saying something about writing. And we started spinning up this idea about the serial adventure novel, and how could you do something like that in modern culture, and how would it work, and how does that sort of fit in with the new way that people are reading? Because we sort of realized that people aren't reading less, they're just reading less at home, in that sense that you spend less time sitting in your comfy chair with your big thick, you know, tome, and more that you're in your train, or you're on your bus, or you're in the car, or you're waiting for a doctor, or, you know, that sort of thing. And so there's more reading in a mobile environment. And if we could figure out how to deliver a serial adventure to people's mobile devices, then we could take advantage of this small increment of time that people have to read these sorts of things. And then there's always this realization of, oh, look, I've got a new piece of the adventure novel. I can sit and read it while I'm waiting for, you know, the ferry or whatever. And so that was sort of the genesis of it. And then the actual idea is basically that it's a medieval adventure novel, in the idea that it's 1241. The Mongol horde has shown up on the doorstep of Europe, knocking and saying, hi, we look like you guys have cool things. We'd like to take them all. And then Europe panicked, tried to figure out what it was going to do. And then suddenly the Mongols picked up and left and never came back, which is one of those weird sort of little tidbits of history that seems too strange to be true, and yet that's exactly what happened. The Mongols just left, and the reason why they left was that their Khan of Khans died in a hunting accident. And when the Khan dies, there's this election that's held to pick the new Khan, and if you want to be considered for that position, you sort of have to be there, which is why they all left. And you can almost see the quotes around hunting accident when you read the historians, and it just seems way too convenient. And that was the kernel of our idea, which is, what if some group of Western martial warriors decided that this is how they were going to save Europe, is that there wasn't enough of them to defeat the Mongols entirely, but if they could affect this change, which would cause the Mongols to go home, then they could save Europe. And that was the genesis of our idea. And as we were spending a lot of time hitting each other with swords and studying Western martial arts, it seemed like a wonderful opportunity to also present some sort of bring some life and some more attention back to these things that have been recently discovered and translated, and there's this growing resurgence in interest of. And so that's sort of how it all came together. It was just one of these little perfect sorts of collection of things. And then, like all writing adventures, it took on a life of its own, and it's gone from there.
So, and talk a little bit. I mean, the content. Well, there are two things I wanted to talk about. A little bit is the content and how you are, when you call it a community-driven enhanced serial novel. Maybe you could explain who the writers are and how you've built this structure to enable community writing.
Right. Well, there's in any given in writing, any given world, and that there's this, if once the fans start enjoying it and consuming it, there's this fundamental desire for more. And it, depending upon how quick the writers write, the fans may either be happy with that or they may start sort of noodling around and coming up with their own stories. And I mean, essentially, fan fiction happens, and you really can't do anything about it, and you really can't stop it. In some ways, you don't want to stop it because it's simply they're extending their enjoyment of the world by participating in it. And so, part and parcel with this idea that the fan fiction happens was the idea that we were trying to figure out a way to deal with the fact that in a digital age, piracy also happens. And it's sort of a losing game to try to really try to stop it, because you end up making it more complicated and difficult for people who are willing to give you money to enjoy something by trying to protect it from being pirated. And so we thought if we build a community and we in, and make it clear that we're happy with the idea of fan fiction happening and it's happening in our community, then it drives people to the community versus, you know, the far flung text files being downloaded and all that stuff. And once you start building this community and this is where it happens and this is where everybody shows up and everybody does everything, then that disparate sort of downloading something in the dark of the night and reading it in the bathroom with a little headlamp on so no one knows that you've pirated it becomes less of an issue. And so that was again kind of the bolting of things together to try to sort of to come up with a solution that would sort of drive the project and generate some of its own steam with it as well. It's just that so that there's this continual sort of feedback loop, or not so much a feedback loop, but a continual sort of loop between creators and consumers that keep the thing sort of verging on this perpetual motion machine.
Right, and so, but the theory is then that the fans can write. I mean, what you do basically is invite people to participate in the telling of the story. And, which is, I know in Japan that's a very, there's a big, I mean, there are some publishers who really support that idea that you get the fans to extend the universe of the story for, manga and things like that. So in the context of, but there has to be a sort of editorial vision that is shared with everyone and that people buy into, even though there's a certain amount of extension possible and you want some creativity to take you in directions that you might not have thought of, you still want there to be a structure within which people work. So that's what you guys do. I mean, that's really the kind of founders and creators have to be responsible for, I take it.
Yeah, and that's been a little thing that we've struggled a little bit with over the last year, was trying to figure out that fine line between laying down rules as far as this is how the world is shaped and these are the rules of these are the rules by which it works, and not limiting the fans' ability to be creative.
No, that's a. I think that's an interesting creative tension that you have to allow for people to take you in a direction that you wouldn't have thought of. That's the, you want that creativity, you want that surprise to happen.
And so then it becomes this issue of, what's canon and what's not, and how do you distinguish between the two in a way that isn't confusing for people, and you don't want to turn it into this thing of this, you don't want to turn it into more people having more conversations about what is and what isn't canon than just enjoying the stories.
Well, say for an established brand, if you're thinking about like Star Wars, which has done lots of extensions, for years and years and years, there have been add-ons, but what they did, and they ended up building the universe, the Bible, and everything takes place within that. It's an established universe, and there's probably less room for creativity. But with the Mongoliad, which is really not starting from an established universe, which millions of people know about, and where you're then responsible for maintaining consistency and accuracy, in your case, you have kind of a different issue. You want to bring in people to create something that doesn't exist yet.
Right. Yeah, and it's been the interesting tension is we've got a number of the fans who've been doing lovely work and have been really have been taking the story and have been taking the world in interesting directions and there's a couple of them that have been trying really hard to figure out how they can connect with the main story,
right?
And writing these really lovely the underbelly of the world, and this is what all the little people are doing sort of things, and trying to anticipate where we're going to go with it and put their people in a way that we, you know, that our people sort of have to run over them in the process of achieving the plot points. And I feel sort of bad about not telling them where things are going, because I really have been enjoying seeing them try to figure it out on their own, which has its own interesting feedback to us, because then we want to be able to be, you know, and that is one of the lovely things about the fact that and this is another lovely thing about the project is that it's because it's a serial and because it's sort of quasi close to real time, we can react and we can be somewhat agile to the drift of where the audience attention is going and where the things that they're liking and the things that they aren't liking, and where they think the story is going. You know, we can sort of react to that much more agilely than if we had written a thing a year ago and it's just now coming out, which
right.
is, you know, the typical method for publishing.
And just to talk a little bit about to be clear about who's involved on the, you know, on the kind of official authorial side, that's, can you just name off everybody who's involved at this point? Because I know it's changed from, you know, how you started, but
right.
who's writing now? Who are the sort of official writers?
The official writers are Neil Stevenson, Greg Bear, myself, Ella de Birmingham, or E.D. Birmingham, Cooper Moo, Joseph Brazzi, and Eric Bear.
I mean, you have a fair number of people.
Yeah.
who, and not all of you are located physically in the same locale.
Right.
So you work, you know, you have to have, you do conferencing weekly or talk to each other every week?
Yeah, Skype is a lovely thing.
Right.
it does make for the ability to have a conference call and have everybody sort of real time talking about it has been really lovely, and you know, with video conferencing and the affordability of that and the ease of that these days makes it so much easier than it used to be.
Now, do you maintain a kind of, I mean, in terms of the working tools, do you work? Again, I mean, it depends on how much detail you want to go into, but did you have to build tools that would enable you to share writing? I'm sort of thinking like a whiteboard where you might have the storyline laid out so that mm-hmm. everybody is aware of it. You'd need to have some sort of virtual equivalent of that, I would think.
Yeah. I mean, there's been some technology building. I mean, that we use the wiki that exists on the Mongolia. Yeah, it's something that we use extensively ourselves, and that's been a really nice way to share data back and forth. Like everything, it tends to roll at its own pace and grow sort of exponentially in strange directions. And I think, you know, we're all used to writing in our own ways and keeping things organized in our own fashion. That's been part of the difficulty is organizing this thing in a way that works for everybody.
Yeah. No, I would imagine, I mean, different writers with different styles.
Yeah.
You have different ways of organizing your thinking. You have different ways of organizing story. You know, some people plot every little inch of a story out. Other people, outline and then fill in as they go and maybe sometimes have to backtrack.
Right.
You know, clearly with six, seven, eight writers as you have, there's got to be different styles involved.
Yeah, and as the showrunner, it's been an experience for me because I'm sort of the guy who, you know, in the technology world, this would be sort of the underlying data translation layer, right? So that I have one writer writes this way, another writer writes this way, and those two ways are slightly incompatible. But when they pass through me, then I do this translation to the thing that the other writer understands. And yeah, there's in some ways it's come down to people saying, well, someone should ask Mark. He knows where all the bodies are buried, or he knows where that data is hiding. And so there's still a, you know, the human engine still runs better than the technology engine in some ways here.
Right. So you end up being, I mean, as you call it, the showrunner, essentially the keeper of the flame, so
right.
that everyone, you know, you're sort of the high priest.
Yeah.
Who has to know all? You have to know all the secrets.
I do, and you know, and then it gets to a point where the time it would take to write all the secrets down is longer than it would be just to keep them on my head until we actually need them. And,
right, but then what happens if you're out of, you know, you're sick or you go on vacation, so
right.
nobody else knows what to do. That's, I mean, I think that's, you know, anybody who's worked in work groups knows and probably understands some of the difficulties that you're facing.
Yeah, eventually, yeah, you get to a point where you're like, oh dear, yes, I have to be encased in a bubble every time I go outside because I cannot afford to get hit by a bus.
Right, well, if you do, then the project is going to change.
Yeah, well, it goes in a different direction, and
that's
okay,
right.
You know.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly. So there's a certain amount of kind of morphing that is allowed, it sounds like.
Yeah, well, and we have these tendencies to have these writers' meetings where everybody will be in a room, and someone who will not be named will deposit a nugget of an idea on the table, and it will lie there, and I will think that it's a steaming pile of S, because I know exactly what's going to happen, which is that it's actually a brilliant little thing, but it's going to change everything. and I'm really hoping that no one will notice it and it will go away. But no, it doesn't. Somebody notices it and then someone else notices it. And then 10 minutes later, it's now, this is the best idea ever. And everything that we've been planning for the last month and a half is now completely no longer valid.
Right. Right.
You know, and the writer who shall be named has got that gleam in his eye. It's just like, oh, you know you're doing this. And he's like, yep, and I'm leaving the room, and it's not your problem.
And
you know, we've had a couple of those, and I mean, they've been lovely because they change things, but it's, you have to be able to be flexible and sort of go that, you know, be okay with it. Look, we're now changing this direction, and you know, especially with the way that the serial nature of things and the fact that we've got stuff that's already published, you have to be careful about making sure that you've got enough hooks early on that you can find a ways to hook this in that doesn't look like you've completely, you know, made it up at the last minute.
Right. No, that's an interesting thing, because you're in real time. If you were writing, I mean, a collaborative group writing a story, I mean, that's not unknown. It happens in television and movies all the time. But what they have the luxury of not releasing any of what they've done until everything is finished. So if you're in a process where maybe five or six people are making contributions, and then two-thirds of the way through somebody says, well, we've got a better idea, and everyone agrees, it means rewriting some and actually maybe reshooting something you did earlier, they can do that, but you can't, because if you change anything radically from what was already committed, it makes it nonsensical. You no longer have a storyline.
Right. And you don't want to betray the readers. I mean, the readers have, you know, it's the whole, you don't want to violate the rules of the universe that you've laid out. And as long as you stick to the rules, the readers will be happy. The readers will follow you anywhere. And as soon as you go, well, I'm gonna change this rule here because it suits the story, then the readers also go, okay, whatever, and they wander off and you've lost them. And so there's that, yeah, it's very difficult to make sure that you don't have that sort of, oh dear, I've written myself into a corner, and the only way out of it is to change the rules. And so, yeah, we have to be careful about how we set things up, and so that this thing can run on rails, and the rails can be laid in a different direction, and it will still work.
Right, and you can't kill off a character who you need for something else later.
Right. Yeah, and that's the really lovely thing about this project that I think everyone's been really been having a great time with, is that when you have seven or eight people, and sometimes we have more in the room, that you it may seem like you've written yourself into a box or written yourself into a corner, but with that sort of brain trust power going, some solution always presents itself, and you figure out a way to move things forward in an interesting direction, and yeah, I think we've been really lucky in that sense, and I think we've been able to adapt really well. And Yeah, I think it adds somewhat to the energy of the project, because it's just sort of this constant sort of evolving thing that is surprising everybody. At least I hope it's surprising everybody.
Well, and what it seems that you have the opportunity to do, and may not be something that, I mean, it's sort of like a balance. It's like you have the ability to work collaboratively as a writer, which can be really rewarding compared to, you know, it doesn't mean you give up the times when you're going to write as an individual where you have total control, you know, or at least the imaginative world is your own. So it is, you know, it's kind of an interesting opportunity to experiment with, you know, collaborative writing.
Right.
And that can be, I would assume that's kind of liberating for a lot of the people involved.
Yeah, I mean, we had a meeting just the other day about wrapping up one of the branches, and we were talking about working through some of the fine details of the last two chapters. And in the process of working through those finer details, we hit upon an opportunity to generate a cliffhanger for this branch, which is lovely because it immediately opens up an opportunity for what we can do with it next and that sort of thing. But in the same time, this cliffhanger now sort of parallels the other two branches and how they resolve. And so suddenly we have this sort of three-way wrap-up of things in a way that seems like it's sort of a thematic cliffhanger or a structural cliffhanger that works across all the branches, which up until 3 days ago, this third branch didn't have that sort of ending. And, you know, the readers will probably be like, oh, it's all nicely wrapped up and everything's sort of, you know, it's got the symmetry across the branches, and they must have been planning this for months. And I'm like, no, not really. It just sort of came together.
Well, that's actually the beauty of accidental discovery, too.
Yeah.
I mean, So in terms of the structure, let's talk a little bit about, I mean, you've been talking about the methodology and how it works. But what's the underlying kind of business structure for the Mongoliad? I know it's part of, you know, the business that is called Subutai. And mm-hmm. maybe you could talk a little bit about what Subutai is and how that, you know, how the Mongoliad fits in. What is, you know, what's enabling, you know, what's paying for you to be able to do all this stuff?
Well, Subutai Corporation is in the transmedia business. That's the short one sentence sort of answer. And the entertainment industry is sort of at this crossroads where they're realizing that they've been working in sort of silos. So the movie industry is one silo, and the game industry is another silo, and the publishing industry is another silo, and they're starting to look beyond their narrow columns of business and see that, you know, like the people who went and saw Avatar the movie were excited about Avatar the game and were excited about tie-in novels and that sort of thing. And that there's an opportunity for one property to generate business in the other silos. And in the past, it hasn't worked out too well. There's a running gag that, you know, between a movie and a video game that are tie-ins, one of the two will suck. And if, you know, the game's good, then the movie will be crap. And if the movie's good, the game will be crap. And that's just sort of, you know, the joke that sort of runs around. And it's because the movie isn't really suited to be a game, but that's the script that the game people are given, right? Or that the game doesn't really work as a movie, but that's what the movie people are given. And their needs, the individual silos are starting to understand that you can't shove that same thing into the different areas, but what you need to be able to do is shove the larger world, and so you need to write something and create something that is appropriate for that media type. And Subutai's argument is that well, yes, we agree, but what you need to do that with is you need to have writers. And so we're kind of coming at it from the other direction, which is that we've got a collection of people who are good at writing in the different media types and who understand the idea. And then the next layer of the argument is that the distance between creatives and consumers is rapidly shrinking, and that pipelines are existing in a way that people who want to pay for your entertainment can talk to you directly, and they can get their content delivered to them directly, And so in many ways, the Mongoliad is sort of a prototype of that methodology, because we're writers. And so we're producing something that we can do fairly easily. And then that the mobile applications and the website and all that sort of thing are demonstrations that in our 21st century, highly mobile, highly wired world, that you can build an audience that will connect with you directly and that will interface with you directly and generate a you know, cash for content sort of a relationship that you can then expand into other media types. And then you have this existing infrastructure and this existing relationship with a very focused audience who is exactly what you're looking for.
So the business model here, you know, is for, and this is, you know, mainly the people probably listening to this podcast are in the publishing business. So here they're probably interested to know, you know, what do you charge a user? Let's say, you know, if I want to join the Mongoliad on a regular basis and see everything that you're doing, I have to pay you for that, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And so right now, I mean, what the app, the purchase price right now is it's a subscription, and it covers season one, which is you know, everything we've done to date, and then there's also the content, and there's some art, and there's some videos, and you know, it's sort of we're testing the functionality and building the pipeline for the sorts of things. And so the idea is that as this grows and as other media types come online, then you know, your subscription would cover, you know, other types of things. And that just sort of becomes a matter of economics.
Right. So what do you charge me if I want to be a subscriber?
So if you want to be a subscriber today, it's $9.95 or $9.99, I think. And that gets you season one, and that's the text and the videos and the art that's been generated so far. And as far as, you know, other media types, those things all take longer to put together. And so those are still things that we're still sort of marshaling our efforts around.
Right. So far, basically, I mean, because you have basically it's the reading that we have.
Yep.
A little bit of video I see is there. And so what's been the response? You know, I know you probably don't want to give out your numbers, but just in terms of, are you happy with the number of people that have subscribed? Is it growing? Are you getting a kind of viral effect so that the more, you know, the more you do, the more people talk about it, the more people subscribe?
Yeah, I mean, we're happy. We're very pleased with what we've seen so far. I mean, it's a sort of growth you get from something that starts fairly low key and then sort of and builds. And so it hasn't hit that viral explosion stage. And that's really hard to capture. I mean, it's capturing the internet's attention at a time when the internet's looking at you, which, you know, it's that sort of strange internet magic. You know, and it's something that we're still, you know, we're constantly sort of focusing on and trying to figure out, where the internet's looking and what's the keyword that will get their attention and you know, go from there. And I think a lot of it comes down to, you know, generating content in a way that people want to talk about it and generating something that people want to come, that want to be a part of. And you know, that's the longer term piece of it. You know, unfortunately, I'm a writer, and the other writers are writers, and this whole marketing thing is something that we sort of aren't very savvy about, and it's not writing, which we would rather be doing.
So does that mean? I mean, do you have somebody as a, you know, is there a marketer involved? Is somebody?
No. There's some of the other people down in the San Francisco team. That's their focus, and so they're working on that sort of thing. Corey Doctorow, who is one of the things that Corey is known for, is that he's sort of initiated this trend of putting novels up on the internet and demonstrating that it doesn't kill your sales. He just put together a collection, I think it was called With a Little Help from My Friends, or With a Little Help. Anyway, it was a collection that he put together, and it was going to be very much, I'm going to self-produce it, self-publish it, self-market it, and do everything myself and demonstrate and sort of learn and figure out how this all works and whether or not that I, who've got a, you know, he who's got a fairly good presence on the internet, can he turn this into this thing where I don't need the publishing world anymore and I can do it all myself? And he wrote an article about his results think it was in Publishers Weekly, maybe it was in Locus, that recently, where he admitted that the marketing and that whole side of things was harder than it looked, and he learned quite a number of things. And it's, you know, it can very easily chew up all of his life. And it's not just a matter of sending out 1,000 copies of the book and getting in front of the right people. It's, you know, it's that next step. Those 1,000 people actually have to read it and then say something about it. And, you know, that suddenly becomes out of your hands.
Yeah, no, I think that is something that writers, you know, we're in a period, I think, of vast disruption. And I think it's fair to say that all sorts of functions are up for grabs. But, you know, at a certain point, things, you know, things may settle down. You know, you may be in a period of flux where things appear to be possible that may not be as possible as they first appear, but you can't get to the next stage until you go through this one. So, you know, I think marketing and, you know, the whole notion of how writers connect with readers is really changing. I think what is interesting to me about the Mongoliad is that you really are at the crux of a possibility, one of the possibilities for how the relationship between writers and readers could be different. And it'd be, right. You know, I think it's, you know, you have to consider it as an experiment. But it's really interesting because it's not just one writer experimenting, you know, with posting things in a different way, which, you know, because you have many writers involved and you've right. engaged the fans. So, you know, that's I think a real question is, you know, this whole idea of how fan involvement might not only drive the story forward, but can it actually then drive the, you know, drive the visibility forward as well? You know, if publishers would, you know, looking at an anthology, you say, well, I've got 50 contributors. That's 50 people who will be marketing my book rather than one author.
Right.
So theoretically, you've multiplied your marketing ability in the sense of, you know, kind of authentic, involved readers who are now writers. They become more than just fans. They become participants.
Right, so. and that's a thing that all small independent presses deal with, was the idea that, you know, they start off with anthologies. Some of them do. I mean, that's the model is you start off with an anthology with a bunch of people who will give you a story, and they will bring their audience, right? So you've got this sort of built in. I'm going to start, and I'm going to have X numbers just out of the gate because I've got these people who are going to bring these people, right? And that's sort of how you jumpstart things. And you know, the difficulty with that is that what do you do next? And I think that's what really is the underlying thing that writers need to sort of wrap their heads around. And I think that the ability to self-publish and it not be a huge stamp of shame or you know, it's self-published, therefore it's crap. I mean, I think that's going away. I mean, I think in many ways it's still true, but in many ways it's also changing because there are enough people who are doing it and are generating significant income from it that they're not anomalies anymore. They're sort of the leading edge of a trend. And a lot of that comes down to looking at the readers, and the readers are happy to read something that they like. And if there's more of it, they're extra happy. And, you know, the people who've done these amazing sort of bootstrap self-publishing careers in this new era, you look at the fact, and it's not they've sold one book. They've got half a dozen books, and they're putting another one out every 6 months. And so their revenue stream is their backlist and not the one book. And I think that that's, you know, I have conversations with new writers and the question of what should I be doing? How should I be starting my career? I'm like, you should be writing, and you should be writing a lot. And if you send your book out and nothing happens with it, that's okay. Write another one, you know, and because you've got to have this pipeline of content coming out of you.
Well, it also helps you build the quality of your work. It's like you're
sure.
putting in your hours and hours, you know, you're building your chops. It's musicians talk about this too, you know, have right. to do 10,000 hours. You gotta do it, and you have to do
right.
it a lot. You have to do it, you know, musicians play with other people. They have to put in hours of practice, but I think there's a good comparison there for writers that, you know, you gotta write.
Right. Yeah, you got to get your million words of crap out of you.
Right.
And I mean, and in some ways, it's you know, if you look at the publishing industry in the past, the way they do it is they would, someone would write a decent first novel, and the publishing industry would pick it up, and they pay a very small advance, but they'd lock you into two or three more books. Right. And so by the time it's your third or fourth book rolled around, they'd move you up to trade or they move you up to hardback because you would have improved and you would have built an audience. And because money's tight and things are changing, the publishing industry is sort of running sort of a lot leaner, and they're not as interested in building those careers that they would have been 10 or 20 years ago. And so I think that in some ways what these writers might want to consider, and this is honestly, if I was starting out, I would seriously think about this. If, you know, if my first book didn't get picked up immediately, why not do the self-publishing route? Why not get it out there? Because in 2 years or 3 years from now, it's going to be where I was 2 or 3 years ago, and I really don't want that to be my first book. But if it's been generating me income this last 2 or 3 years, however meager, then, you know, that's okay. You know, and then so you sort of build your own pipeline and your own backlist, and so that by the time you get to your third or fourth book, which would be the one that New York would really want to spend some money on marketing you on anyway, you can now go to New York and say, I'm ready for this next level, and by the way, I've got 5,000, 10,000 readers who've been buying my last couple books, and I have a direct connection with them because they've been buying them on the internet, so I am now showing up to you with a better product and a audience. And, you know, suddenly you enter at level two instead of at level one versus toiling forever waiting for someone to, you know, and going through that dark era of, oh my gosh, I've got this trunk full of books that are my level one books that no one's ever going to see. And possibly despairing and possibly giving up and not going through with it. You know, I think it's a possible way of looking at what the new opportunities are, that you have a little more control over that early stage of your development, and there's more opportunities for you to find your own path versus waiting for someone to discover you and take the chance.
So do you think that sort of applies here to Mongoliad, that you guys are building something, you know, that may be, you know, if you can build a substantial audience for this project, you could potentially find traditional publishers who might be interested in what you're doing. You know, is that part of your plan, or are you just not worrying about that and just want to see how it goes and what direction things, you know, where do things end up?
No, that's part of the plan. I mean, there's been conversations with traditional publishers off and on for many months about, you know, how this can be leveraged into their existing infrastructure, or how their infrastructure can become part of it, you know, our infrastructure, and how the Pulp, which is the personal ubiquitous literature platform, it's our acronym for the pipeline, you know, how this, that sort of pipeline can work for them. And yeah, so it's in many ways the Mongoliad is, on one hand, is it's, you know, serial adventure fiction that people are enjoying, but on the other hand, it's also a technology demonstration that we're you know, looking to leverage in ways that you know, the publishing industry can take advantage of in this new era, and that authors can take advantage of in this new era if they want to, and that sort of thing.
So actually, that's actually something I'd forgotten to think about, that in fact, this could, what you're building, you could license out to other people who could use it to build something similar.
Yeah.
You know, maybe a science fiction or fantasy group wanted to do something, or whatever it could be. That could be, you know, that's some IP asset for you.
Yeah.
Got it.
Absolutely.
No, that's very interesting. Well, it obviously is a tremendously interesting experiment. I've read quite a bit of material on the site and found it to be really engaging. I have not downloaded the iPad or Android apps. Those both seem really interesting also, because I think, that, as you described it, it's sort of the reading on the fly opportunity is really important to this. It's just, you know, just I haven't happened to be able to use it yet. But,
right.
You know, it seems like, or, you know, this is something I want to check in with you on at another time, you know, later on,
sure,
down the road, see how things are going. I've really been really glad to have the opportunity to talk to you, Mark.
Sure. Right.
So this has been David Wilk talking for Publishing Talks to Mark Teppo about the Mongoliad. And just as a reminder, you can take a look at the Mongoliad yourself at mongoliad.com. Download the iPhone app or the Android app. Both of them are available. And I think it's a really interesting project.
Yeah, well, thank you. I mean, and the final thing on the apps is that it is very much a one account works everywhere sort of thing.
Got it.
So that you can have an account on the site, and you can also get your Android or your iPad app, and it will, it's the same account.
Right. One subscription gets you everything.
Gets you everything anywhere you want to be. Right.
That's great. Well, appreciate it, Mark, and good luck with the project.
All right. Well, thank you.
Thanks.